great Uncle Silas was dying. I did not believe it. He was so old that it had always been hard for us that he'd ever been born. It seemed to me that he'd simply turned up, very old and imperishable. Yet I remember how he would often tell me that he could recollect, standing on a corn sheaf in his frocks and sucking at the breast his mother slipped out of her dress and held down for him in the harvest field.
They had the titty them days, till they were damn near big enough to reap and tie. Are always tardy thirsty,
he would say at the end of that story, or in fact, at the end of any story.
Mouth full of wine?
It was his favourite phrase. It was early autumn, in the middle of harvest, when I heard that he was dying. If it had been winter or even spring, I might have believed it, but in autumn, at the harvest, it was unthinkable, absurd. The very words, Silas is dying, seemed fantastic. Moreover, I'd heard them before. Hearing them once, I'd hurried over to see him for the last time, only to find him up a ladder, pruning his apple trees with a jackknife, all of a muck sweat, with his jacket off in the winter wind. I heard you were dead, I said. He hawked and spat with a sort of gay ferocity.
Ever hear the tale of the old gal who heard I were dead and buried, and then seen me in the swan? She never touched another drop.
When the news again came that he was dying, I thought of his words. But unexpectedly, there came other news.
They say Silas don't know what he's doing half the time.
Not Silas is ill, or Silas is dying, or even Silas is unconscious, but Silas doesn't know what he's doing. The words were ominous, a contradiction of my Uncle Silas's whole life, his principles, his character, his amazing cunning, his devilish vitality. For what separated my Uncle Silas from other men was exactly this. He knew what he was doing. How often had I heard him say, with a cock of his bloodshot eye and the most devilish darkness,
"I know what I'm a-doing, me boyo. I know what I'm doing."
The day after hearing the news, I went over to see him. It was lovely September weather, the air breathless, the sunshine very soft, and the pale amber colour of new wheat straw. And I saw the smoke rising from the chimney as I walked up the lane to the house. It was a good sign. If the smoke were rising, my Uncle Silas was at home. If he were at home, it was 1,000 to 1 in summertime that he was in the paddock or the garden, or if not there, by his cheddo. But that afternoon he was not in the paddock, where the wheat stood ripe and half-mown, and I could not see him in the garden, where the pears lay wasp-sucked and rotting in the yellowing grass. Walking up the garden path, I frightened a jay off the pea-rose. I stopped at once, but my Uncle Silas did not appear. A jay on the pea-rose, and no sign from my Uncle Silas. I stepped over the threshold and looked into the room. The house was the same as ever, with the same eternal smell of earth and tea, of wood smoke and balm, of geranium leaves and wine. There was even the faint earth smell of my Uncle Silas himself, but his chair was empty. The housekeeper appeared a moment later, as scrawny and frigid as ever. But that afternoon she looked tired. She seemed relieved to see me, and she broke out at once.
"Oh, dear, he'll wear me out."
There was a sort of melancholy affection for him in her voice, and I knew at once that there must be something wrong. "Where is he?" I asked. But before she could reply, his own cracked voice called suddenly,
"I'm in here, me boyo, in here."
"Where's that?"
"In the parlour, all among the foldy dolls. Come in."
As I walked across the passage between the two rooms, the housekeeper entreated me in a whisper,
"The doctor says you mustn't tire him."
My Uncle Silas, not to be tired. He, who could have mown a 40-acre field and not be tired? It was all over, I thought, as I pushed open the parlour door and went in and met the stale antimacassar odour of the closed room. And there, under the window, on an old black couch of American leather, with a green horse rug over him and his sun-brown arms lying uselessly over the rug, lay my Uncle Silas. By his side was the night commode, and a little bamboo table with two wine glasses and two bottles of lemon-coloured and blackish medicine on it.
Now, don't go and talk and tire yourself, said the housekeeper.
Go and wring yourself out, you old wet sheet, he croaked.
What's that? If you ain't careful, I'll pack me bag and leave you lying there.
Pack it and good riddance.
I will.
She flashed off to the door. It was the old game. She was always leaving and never leaving. My Uncle Silas was always dismissing her and always keeping her.
Look, Slippy, and bring us a bottle of cowslip, and don't talk so much.
But she was outside the door without a word and not heeding him before he had finished speaking. He lay back on the sofa gloomily.
Won't even let me wet me whistle.
He lay silent for a moment or two, his eyes watery, his chest heaving a little.
"I puff like an old frog," he said.
I did not answer, and until he regained his breath and his calmness, I could not look at him again, and I let my eyes wander over the room instead, over the fol-de-dols he hated so much, the accumulated knick-knacks of nearly 100 years. To find him there, among them, was a tragedy itself. He loved living things. And the only living things in that room were ourselves and the afternoon sunlight yellowing the closed window. Well, I said, what's the matter with you? He shook his head.
I ain't worth a hatful of crabs.
I could hardly bear the words. To hear that he didn't know what he was doing, to see a jay on his P-Rose, to find that he mustn't drink or talk or tire himself, and now to hear him say, I ain't worth a hatful of crabs. My heart sank. It seemed to mean that his spirit was already dead. And no sooner had I thought it, the half-cockney with a faint curve of the old cunning.
See that jay on the P-Rose?
Yes.
Oh, jay him.
Then, with a sudden satanic flash of his bloodshot eye that surprised and delighted me, he whispered,
"Mouthful of wine."
I sat astonished. "I thought they wouldn't let you drink," I said. He winked.
"In the medicine bottles, elderberry in the dark and cowslip in the light. Pour out. Mouthful of cowslip for me."
Smiling, I poured out the wine, and he lay smiling back at me with all his old subtlety and wickedness. As I gave him the glass, he whispered,
"I'll fill him a nights when she's abed."
"What's the doctor say?" I asked.
"Says another drop of wine'll kill me."
He finished his wine and wiped out the glass on the horse blanket before putting it back on the table. The wine twinkled in his eyes and had already flushed away the dead yellow colour of his skin. And suddenly he shot up in bed, craning his thick, tough neck to look out of the window.
"That jay again! God damn it, go and get my gun!"
I knew he meant it, and I rose at once and went to the door. But he'd raised his voice, and the housekeeper had heard him. She was in the room again, almost before I had moved, with the old despairing cry,
"Oh, he'll wear me out!"
She seized him sternly, forcing him back onto the pillows, while he shouted at her,
"You interfering old tit! I'll shoot that jay if I have to shoot you first!"
"You'll take your medicine now, jay or no jay, and then get some sleep."
As she took up the dark medicine bottle and poured out his measure into the wine glass, he kept lolling out his tongue, sick fashion, and rolling his eyes and complaining.
"Oh, it's like drinking harness oil and vinegar. Ugh."
"Drink it."
She forced the glass into his hands, and he crooked his elbow on the pillow, lolling his tongue in and out. She turned away to draw down the blinds. No sooner was her back turned than he lifted his glass and gave me a swift, marvellous look of the wickedest triumph, licking his thick red lips and half-closing his bloodshot eye. "I'll come and see you again," I said, with my hand on the door-latch.
"Ah, do. I'll send the taters out next week and the wheat down. Come and give us a hand."
A faint shadow of that wicked and triumphant smile flickered across his face.
"So long, me boyo."
Outside in the garden, I asked the housekeeper what was the matter with him.
"It's senile decay," she said. "He's losing the use of his legs, and half the time he don't know what he's doing. It's just the medicine that keeps him going.
I had no doubt it was. But one morning, a week later, I heard that he was dying, and in the afternoon I went over to the house. A gentle rain had been falling all morning, a quiet, whispering September rain, and the air, very still and sultry, was saturated with the fragrance of wet pines. Crossing the paddock, I noticed that the wheat had been mown and half-banded, and that the elderberries had gone from the garden hedge. Looking across the rank thicket of dahlias, I caught a glimpse of a dead blue jay strung on a hazel stick among the pea-rose. The housekeeper came to meet me at the door, her finger uplifted, with her lips pursed tight to silence me. "How is it with him?"
"Bad. Very bad. He won't say tomorrow."
"Can I see him?"
"He won't know you. He's very strange."
"Yes, he was very strange. He began to turn day into night, she told me, and would doze all day, and then, in the dead of night, while she was asleep, he would wake and ferret in the cellar, or mow his wheat, and dig his potatoes, and gather his elderberries for wine. She had suspected nothing until, awakened early one morning by a gunshot, she'd hurried into the garden to find him stringing up a dead jay in his pea-rose. It seemed that sometimes, too, he would drink his medicine in one swig, by the bottleful. He was as far gone as that. When she had finished speaking, I went into the house to look at him. He lay there, as before, on the leather couch among the fol-de-dols, the green horse rug over him and his brown hands lying listlessly outside it. He seemed to be asleep, yet there was something half-alert about the expression of his closed eyes, as though he were listening to me, or perhaps to the rain. I stood for a moment watching him, and suddenly his eyes half-opened, and a gaze that had in it some of the old strength and wickedness rested on me darkly. In a moment his lips moved too.
"What's the weather?"
"It rains."
"Let it."
It was a flash of the old spirit. In a moment it was gone, and his lips closed without another sound, and his eyelids lowered with a sharp flicker that was like a last wink at me. I never heard him speak again. When we went into him in the evening, he'd turned day into night for the last time. The rain had ceased. The sun had broken through and was shining on the empty medicine bottles and his dead hands.
My Uncle Silas was written by H.E. Bates and abridged and read by David Neal. The programme was produced by Cherry Cookson.